The hour of 8:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and the Elections Committee. We have two bills on the agenda today, members, and the first bill is 2899. 2899 has a significant delete everything amendment. So I'm going to sending this to where criminal civil justice. I'm going to move that House File 2899 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to civil justice, and then I'm going to move the delete everything amendment, the DE1, and we're going to take testimony today on the delete everything amendment. Once we get a quorum, we'll put the delete everything amendment on. I'll then lay the bill over until Tuesday when we'll take action on the bill, so that we can let everybody take a look at this amendment and make sure that they're either comfortable with it or that we have all of the changes. So I would like to have first Mark Affenson from the Minnesota Newspaper Association come up. And we're on the, and Sandy Nieren is here. Well, Sandy, you can come up first.
Thank you.
Sandy, we're on the DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Members of the committee.
So to the DE1 amendment, which yes. I've already passed, we haven't put it on yet, but I've already brought it up.
Okay.
We'll put this into the bill as soon as we have a quorum, and then we're going to speak to the DE1 amendment, okay. What it does, because it does significantly change the bill.
Okay.
And we'll take testimony today, and I will lay the bill over until Tuesday, where we will take action.
Okay. Maybe Daryl can come down, too. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Nieren. I'm with Meserly and Kramer, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association.
Excuse me, one minute. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, would it be your intent then on Tuesday to take further testimony as well, if necessary?
Yes. Representative Biskins, my intent would be to take further testimony on Tuesday if there are concerns with the Delete Everything Amendment, and that's why we're going to lay it over for the weekend to make sure everyone has a firm understanding of what this amendment does.
Thank you, Ms.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Ms. Nieren?
I just want to give you a quick background of how this bill got here and why it's in the shape it is right now. For a number of years, the Newspaper Association has been approached by legislators on both sides of the aisle to help try and figure out a better enforcement mechanism for violations of both the Open Meeting Law and the Data Practices Act. And quite frankly, most of the solutions that we came up with in the past were not ideal, and we set them aside pretty rapidly. Over this last interim, Representative Pawlowski had wanted to work on this issue again. Representative Holberg asked us to work on this issue again. We came up with a concept several months ago to use a procedure that was put in place by this legislature in 2004 for the handling of unfair campaign complaints. Those of you who were here then may remember that this bill passed in 2004. All unfair campaign complaints were taken out of the court system and out of the county attorney's office and given to the Office of Administrative Hearings for a very fast, speedy, and cheaper resolution than was presently happening with the old mechanism. So we vetted this idea with a number of legislators, with a number of groups, to see what kind of reaction we'd get, and it was fairly positive. So we drafted the bill. Representative Pawlowski and Senator Betzold introduced the bill, and since that time we have met quite often with various stakeholders who have an interest in this. We've met with towns, we've met with cities, we've met with counties, we've met with school boards, with county attorneys, with Department of Administration, and the Delete Everything Amendment that you see before you today is a result of compromises that were made to make these various groups find this proposal acceptable. This bill was heard in the Senate yesterday. None of those groups testified against it, and it passed unanimously out of the Senate committee yesterday. So our hopes are that we will continue to work with these groups. This bill will need to go to Civil Justice Committee after it's acted on favorably by this committee, and we have assured all these groups that if any additional issues arise, we will be glad to try and work out compromises on this. It is not our goal to pass anything that is objectionable to any of the stakeholders who are involved in these issues. We do want everybody to be comfortable with the language. So that is the background of how this bill got here. I will turn it over
Members, before we continue, I wanted to make sure we put the bill in order. So my motion is on the DE1 amendment, and I believe we have a quorum at this time. So members, I would like to put the amendment on so that the bill's in order. Then we'll continue to take testimony and questions on the bill as amended. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now we have the bill in the form that the author wishes to have it. And Mr. Aaron, could you walk us through the DE1 amendment, just so everyone understands what it is before we take testimony?
As I mentioned when we started, the bill originally was drafted to set up a mechanism so that those who had complaints about violations of the Data Practices Act, in other words, your constituents who ask for copies of clearly public data and violations of the open meeting law, would, instead of going to district court, would be set up in an administrative process at the Office of Administrative Hearings. We have dropped the open meeting law from this proposal, from the Delete Everything Amendment. So this bill, in its present form, simply permits someone who has a complaint about not having access to public data to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings instead. I do have someone, Bruce Johnson is here from the Office of Administrative Hearings, if there are any questions about that. The process would be someone would file a complaint, they'd pay a filing fee. The office, on very short timelines, certainly much shorter than actually going to court on these matters, would have probable cause findings, would permit the governmental agency to respond, and we've put in timelines that the government agencies have told us they're okay with, and then would make a determination whether or not there should be release of the data or not. The complainant who brings the complaint would get back 100% of the filing fee if they prevail in this action, and then the governmental agency would pay the Office of Administrative Hearings cost up to a cap of $1,000. If the complainant lost, the Office of Administrative Hearing costs would be taken out of their filing fee and the balance would be returned to them if there is a balance. And if the if any complainant is bringing frivolous or harassing complaints against government, and we do know there are some people who do that, the Office of Administrative Hearings would have the ability to keep the entire filing fee and also require that person to pay the government agency's costs for having to defend themselves against a frivolous or harassing complaint. So we've attempted to put some balance into the process and make some changes that would be beneficial to both individuals and also protective of government so that they don't get harassed. That's basically the process we've put in place in this bill. Some of the bill is cross-references to current law and such, but I think that's the best basic explanation.
Members, this bill has gone through at least four drafts prior to the draft that you saw before you and the DE1 amendment. There's been considerable work over the last 6 months on this bill to attempt to address the concerns that you're going to hear today from the testifiers. And I want to particularly thank Ms. Nearin for her work. Most of what you see here is the work that she's done with the Newspaper Association, Mr. Ehrlich's here to testify, but also the Office of Administrative Hearing. Mm-hmm. If we prevail with this bill, we will be taking also some burdens off our district courts. Mm-hmm. And the district courts, as you know, have been cut severely over the last few sessions. There's a proposal now to cut them again. This would simplify a process, but also get public information hopefully more readily available and in a venue that would also make sure that it's done in a proper format. So I want to thank all of the people who have worked the last 6 months on the drafts and on this bill. I think Mr. Ehrlich's come the farthest to testify, so that's why he gets to come up first. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Darrell Ehrlich, and I am the editor of the Winona Daily News, and I'm also the associate editor of the River Valley Newspaper Group, which includes the Houston County News and the La Crosse Tribune. Thank you for taking time in this busy session to hear a bill aimed at making good government that we are so richly blessed with in Minnesota even better in a year in which all the focus seems to be on the bottom lines. So let me give you a couple of bottom lines. Minnesota has good government, and Minnesota has good public information laws. A large amount of my work as an editor and a journalist is showing the residents of southeastern Minnesota what their government is doing. In so many cases, in story after story, we demonstrate local and state officials doing good work in the lives of citizens of this great state. Though journalists in other parts of the country may hear an endless barrage of no comment, information is in the great majority of stories we cover turned over without quibble or delay. In my experience as a journalist working in five other states, I can safely say that Minnesota laws regarding public data and public information are quite simply the best I've gotten the pleasure of working with. The Minnesota Data Practices Act is not only a comprehensive set of laws, it seems reasonably fair and strikes a pretty good balance between the public's right to know and protecting the privacy of individuals and vulnerable people. In my role as an adjunct professor at Winona State University, I've had the opportunity to teach sections of the Data Practice Act, which inevitably leads to discussion of what should the public know and how do ordinary citizens keep tabs on state and local government. We discuss why juvenile and crime victims should be anonymous. We discuss how driver's license and social security numbers are left out of police reports and why just stamping the word draft on a document doesn't necessarily keep it out of the public's purview. Yet there are some exceptions to the very positive work the Minnesota Data Practices Act does. Let me give you two examples that I've witnessed firsthand. One local public official denied our public data records request, citing at length from British Admiralty law. The second example happened when another public official sitting right across from me in my office said his interpretation of reasonable response time was either when he felt like being reasonable or when hell froze over. Both cases illustrate the challenges of enforcing the very good Data Practices Act. There is a lack of understanding of the law which leads officials grasping and sometimes finding only admiralty law. The other situation we run into is public officials who understand that reasonable is not defined and take the law's lack of precision as permission to forestall the release of public data. In such situations, our only recourse, the only one prescribed by law, is taking a public entity or official to court. There are two significant barriers to doing this that this legislation that you have before you helps remedy. The first hurdle is one of costs. Fighting of data practices claim in district court, as recommended by law, means an investment of $5,000 to $10,000 minimally. While this price tag would weigh heavy on a news organization of any size, it serves as a complete deterrent to claims, legitimate or not, brought by members of the public. The legal fees are simply too onerous. But for us, those of us who work in the journalism profession, the even more problematic issue is one of time. Those pursuing a lawsuit to obtain public access may look at 3 to 6 to 12 months to get a case resolved. And heaven help us if that case is appealed. In almost all cases, when a public record is finally released, the news value has been eclipsed. But more importantly, the public has no chance to see its own government in action and act accordingly. I am, of course, a journalist and a representative of my profession. But it cannot be underscored enough. I am not here solely as a journalist. This bill that you have before you does not carve out a privileged class for journalists. In fact, in a large number of data practices requests made around the state come from individual citizens looking to their own officials for information. I am here today because it just so happens that journalists as a group use this set of laws more often. We have more familiarity with them. The bill that you have before us is a creative solution that seems to knock down some of the nearly insurmountable barriers that our current law and current court structure engender. It allows a proceeding to be completed more expeditiously and at a lesser cost. It does not take away the option of district court, yet this creative solution outlined in this bill saves taxpayer money and takes stress off an already overburdened court system. And you should know that it gives Minnesota the opportunity to become a leader in another good government initiative. I said earlier that I have worked in several other states, and the problem that I describe is not unique to Minnesota. Rather, it's endemic to many states, including all those which border Minnesota. However, you should also know that the press associations in South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, as well as Nebraska, are watching and looking to us for what I believe is a measure not only to make good government work, but make good government work better.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Biskins. Did you have a question to the testifier?
Yes.
All right. Questions to Mr. Ehrlich? Seeing no questions. Thank you. You may be called back at some point, but Mr. Etheson, you want to testify? No. Mr. Neumeister. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For many years, I have been a citizen, still am, for no money at all, bringing up points of view about privacy and openness in government. And I've interacted with a great number of you over the decades. Maybe you've not all been here decades, but a number of your predecessors before them. Now, the bill before you, I have to laud Representative Pawlowski, Senator Betzolt, and others who have tried to do something about to enforce and to make government entities comply with the Data Practices Act. But as always, what happens is when there are attempts historically here at the legislature, the government entities who have lawyers, who have lots of associations in a lot of cities and a lot of entities to lobby, start to do little changes in the things that make it very hard for the citizen to do things. And that's what has happened with the DE1 amendment. If you take a difference between how it was done or as it introduced and now, there are some differences. And there have been some deals made that are not in the interest of citizens. Now, the Newspaper Association, I laud them. And historically, the Newspaper Association lauds and does strive for citizens in some of the things that they do. But they have the bully pulpit of the editorial, the bully pulpit of a reporter, and they have the bully pulpit of a very good attorney with Mark Amundson and some other attorneys that represent some of the other media interests. So it's my intention in my public testimony to you today is to highlight some things specifically in this bill that I would very much encourage you, and I have to applaud you, Chairman Pawlowski, for letting some time to settle in so some people can go back, maybe look at certain points that are made or whatever, to really have good public policy. So I applaud you for that. As we begin, I would like to take you on to page 3 of the bill.
And Mr. Neumeister, you are working off the DE1 amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
DE1 amendment. I would like to suggest a change after, on line 1, after the word chapter, put and rules, so that it's very important that the administrative hearing officer can also deal on issues of rules. On 3.5, now, some people I see Representative Simon, Mr. Chairman, who has sit historically on the data practice, civil law, maybe some others, and some on the education committee. You know, one of the most important things for a parent when they fight for their child's right is, whatever it might be in the school context, is to be able to get access to their children's information, to advocate for special programs, or let's say a young person is disciplined wrongly or whatever. Well, if you take a look at 3.5, on line 5 here, 1332 is the educational part of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. This is one of the special deals that was made with the Minnesota School Boards and other interests association that says that parents or students cannot use this process to get the school districts to comply with the law to give basic information about their kids, which they have a right to. And historically, many school districts have fought on those issues because sometimes they know the information about their kid shows the school districts in a different light. This needs to be removed, I would encourage you. So on beginning at line 3.4 through 3.5, I encourage that an action may not, until the end of the sentence, be deleted. Now, one of the things, and maybe other testifiers who might be here today can give some other examples of situations. I can, or if, I got some documentation in that regards, if down the line there's interest. On line 3.14, One of the things I would like to encourage is that $1,000 is still a lot of money. And so one of the things I would like to suggest is maybe either lowering that or, as in, again, one of the many drafts, which I was able to get a copy of, and just as a courtesy to share with you, over the 6 months, I was not part of the, I'm not an organization, I'm not, and so it's only by just asking questions and all that that I've generally have got information. So it's only in the last week or so, 2 weeks, that I've been starting to interact a lot with some of the folks involved. But one of the drafts they had, if you look on page where I said 314, and at the end at 316, where they had this language: the office may waive the payment of the filing fee if the individual seeking a waiver of the fee files with the office, which is OAH, an affidavit stating that the individual is financially unable to pay to help the person. So that's one aspect, I think. The other item now is, if you go further on down, is on page 5. Where it says on 519 and 535. One of the things, this is again some of the things that some legal lease type things. I'm not a legal lawyer, but I know over my 3 decades plus looking at these kinds of things at the legislature and other places, and I'll point out specifically those items, that they present barriers to individuals. And I'll point those out, and maybe between now and Tuesday you could get more aspects. That's on page 519, line 19, where it says a rebuttable presumption. 522 and 523, where it says attorney's fees may be denied if the judge determines the violation is technical or that there's a genuine uncertainty about the meaning of the governing law. And on line 35, where it says brought for purposes of harassment. So that's another item that I would like to see either taken out or add certain language. From my perspective, where it says or brought for purposes of harassment by clear and convincing evidence would be one option. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, those are some of my points. I applaud what Representative Pawlowski and folks are trying to do, but I just come from a different perspective on some things, and it's very important. This is not just a bill for access to public information. Secondly, the Data Practices Act gives privacy rights to citizens, like the Tennyson warning, and access to private data, which I was talking about, like that 1332 as an example. And number two, what we're trying to do here, and I'll just use this as, I'll call this government using my sign language. This is the citizen using the C. And what we're trying to do here in this bill is to create parity for that citizen on the issue of data practices and to be able to get some of the things that I've enunciated. With some aspects of the bill, as I've at least pointed out, I think there's still that parity not fully achieved yet, or maybe moved just a little, but hopefully over the weekend and as the bill progresses become much better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the time that you've allotted me.
Ms. Nairn, would you like to come up and respond?
Mr. Chair, I'm very embarrassed that I didn't have my glasses on when we looked at the delete everything amendment. It appears as if the wrong version was put into the packet. And
yeah, members, I was just informed by staff that the time on this amendment is 2:55, and apparently the amendment that should have been sent down was 6 o'clock, after 6 o'clock last night.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, Ms. Nairn, the differences between the, is this the correct amendment that's coming out? We're going to have the correct one being passed out now. So can you explain, apparently the wrong one was sent down.
Mr. Chair, I think there were a couple amendments that were made to the bill late in the process yesterday, at the request of certain parties.
Okay, Ms. Darren, before you start, here's what I'm going to do. Let's be sure that the 6:37 p.m. amendment is the correct amendment. Is this the correct one, the DE one?
I'll defer to House Research, but I think that is the correct
one. Mr. Gehring is saying yes.
And I do want to say that House Research staff has been absolutely fantastic in working with us on repeated amendments, and very easy to get confused here about which one was the latest version.
So I'm going to withdraw the...
But I will take responsibility. It's my fault. I should have had my glasses on.
All right. I'm withdrawing the the initial motion on the DE1 amendment that we had. And... Oh, hang on a second. All right, here's what I am going to vote in the new DE1 amendment, and that will delete the old DE1 amendment, and that's why we're waiting till Tuesday to make sure we take a final vote. So I'm going to move the new DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Now, the bill is amended in the form that we wish. So let's go to the new DE1 amendment, the 2:23:10:6:37 p.m. amendment. Ms. Nguyen, can you tell us the significant differences between the two?
Mr. Chair, I think a lot of the amendments that were put on late were technical in nature. One of the substantive amendments that was put on in the last draft was we did delete the language on permitting someone to file a complaint in form of papyrus.
Can you give us the page on the old amendment that was?
On the which one? On the old one?
Yes.
I think, Mr. Neumeister, page 3, line 114 it starts on. Here's the discussion. The bill as originally introduced did not have this language in it at all and did not permit anybody to go to court. You had to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings for these. I was approached by Legal Aid Society who wanted to have the option to file an informer papyrus. The problem with doing that, of course, under this process is we have to pay for this out of filing fees. We cannot have any fiscal note on this, otherwise it won't happen this year. So the goal here was to pay for this entire process through the parties' filing fees and the parties themselves. So what we proposed as an option instead of this was to permit legal aid or anybody else who wants to still go to court where they are eligible to get an inform of papyrus and have filing fees waived. That's why we left that in. But we did take out this language permitting someone to go here to Office of Administrative Hearings through inform of papyrus. I think that's one of the more substantive amendments. Mr. Amfronson wants to correct me. Or was there? I don't think there was anything of other great substance other than which one?
I'd say this one would be right here.
There's language also on line 5.14 that was added at the request of Hennepin County that would make what they were concerned about is they did not want OAH's orders to be binding in any subsequent district court action that someone might bring for damages under the Data Practices Act. So that provision was put in at the request of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
All right, and we're on page 5.14.
That's
those
correct.
Are the lines that were added.
That's
all right.
Correct.
Ms. Nguyen, can you tell me, is this the amendment that was added in the Senate yesterday during their testimony?
I'm sorry?
Is this the amendment that was added
yes,
in the
Senate?
Yes,
the last amendment that was just handed out is what was adopted yesterday and passed out of State and Local Government Committee in the Senate unanimously.
All right, so the bills are tracking reasonably identically at this point.
They should be identical. If I recall correctly, the Senate used the delete everything that Mr. Gehring prepared.
All right, so for members who just came in, the DE1 amendment that was just added is what we are discussing. We'll take testimony today in discussion. I'm going to then lay the bill over until Tuesday, and then we'll take final action on Tuesday. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, would you just allow me a couple minutes just to highlight some of the things that were not in the original DE1?
Mr. Neumeister,
comment on that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the concerns that I highlighted in my previous testimony on the mistaken DE1 are still in there. There just might be a few, you know, few sentences above, few sentences below. So, I mean, I'm tracking on that. So the same concerns that I raised are in the new, whatever, is it the 9:10 a.m.?
Well,
the 9:10 a.m. A2 amendment are in there, except there are some added things that were not in the ones that I talked about. And one of those items was on page 514, 515. And Ms. Nairn talked about it. This was done in by Hennepin County. Again, from my perspective, one of the government interests, a legalese kind of thing that can have impact on an individual. I encourage you to take a look at that. One of the things that I had just a general concern about is that, let's say an LA judge says that the government entity was not complying with the Tennyson warning on an individual and sent all this information, which a person has a right to know, was given to the government, which is private, and now they're sharing it with other people. You get a compliance order, you know, after, say, stop giving this information to this individual, but then you know that this government entity that has this information about you is doing something with it. It may be damaging you or whatever. So I think it's important to be able to use the LA the administrative law hearing decision, if it was in favorable of the citizen, to at least use that as evidence to point out some of the government's mistakes. And so I want to make sure that this does not prevent, you know, a citizen from using an LA judge if they want to go to pursue a violation of disclosure of their privacy rights. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to add that other point.
All right.
I can stand for any questions if there's any.
Questions, Mr. Neumeister? Seeing none, then Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and thank you for the work on this bill over the last few months. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Bruce Johnson. I'm Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. I won't go on at length other than to say that the Newspaper Association got in touch with us right at the outset. We don't take positions on the merits of legislation. Our interest was just coming up with a procedural system that was workable. And as the chair pointed out initially, this process is modeled on the campaign complaint process that was placed in legislation in 2004. And I think by any accounts has been extremely successful. It is fast. It is becoming increasingly less expensive. I think one thing I want to focus on is in the campaign complaint arena, one of the, I guess, unexpected benefits is that we have developed a body of law over the last 6 years that is accessible on our website. And basically, participants in campaigns or prospective complainants can look over past decisions and get an idea on whether there was a violation of law or not. And as a result of that, the number of complaints has progressively declined in each of the last several years, and the cost of the process has also declined. And quite honestly, we expect the same thing, that particular effect to happen here. In other words, as there is a body of law that people can consult on our website, we really believe that the number of complaints and the number of violations will decrease, because people will know, at least have a sense from prior decisions, whether what they're doing or proposed to do violates the law or doesn't violate the law. I can also say that We have carefully costed this. One of the main changes from the campaign complaint process is these proceedings will be heard by a single judge rather than a three-judge panel, which cuts the cost by a third. And we have rigorously gone through the numbers here, and we are very confident that we can hear these cases for, on average, about $1,000 a case. We have two extremely competent staff attorneys who know quite a bit about the Data Practices Act. They will be intimately involved in the complaint process and in the drafting process. So we are very confident we can do that for the amount of money, that this can be a self-sustaining program, that it would require no funding from the legislature. That's really all I have to say, but if members have questions, I'd be happy to entertain
them. Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chairman, I have questions to the bill and of the author.
And to the author or to the testifier?
To the author.
Okay. Any questions to Mr. Johnson? Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Johnson, I have a little concern about how the appropriations section is written in this bill. I don't remember. Is this exactly the way all of your appropriation is done? We usually don't like, I understand the setting aside of a special account. I thought we usually like to appropriate from that special account instead of just having it automatically appropriated. How does the rest of your office
operate? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, actually, most of our state agency operations, I believe it's Minnesota Statutes 14.55, and that particular statute, we charge agencies by the hour for the time we spend on their cases, and that statute does automatically appropriate those receipts. All I can say is that we referred this particular part of the bill to the Department of Management and Budget, and our executive budget officer is the one I think was intimately involved in drafting that part of the legislation. I personally don't have the expertise to say whether it works the way it should or something like that.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I assume the bill is going to finance.
Yes, Representative Kahn. It's going to go to Civil Justice if it makes it out of this committee Tuesday, and then it would have to go to finance,
okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Kahn.
Mr.
Johnson.
If there are concerns, if you do have concerns about that, I suggest that that House Finance staff get in contact with our executive budget officer, and if there's a better way of doing this, we're certainly receptive to that.
Mr. Johnson, we might be able to handle that question Tuesday also.
Okay.
That gives us 4 days to do it, so we can do that. Representative Kahn, are you finished?
Sure.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do have a question first on 6.4. I'm interested in why the substantially prevailing complainant would still be charged a $50 fee for bringing a complaint when the judge actually found that the complaint was valid. It prevents a barrier, especially for those who are not well off to bring these complaints forward.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can speak to that at least to some extent. Again, we weren't the drafters of the bill. Mm-hmm. However, we have a $50 filing fee for all cases that we hear, that there's a certain amount of time and effort just in processing a complaint. And in fact, the campaign complaint statute itself designates a $50 filing fee. All I can say is that the filing fee in this process is consistent with everything else we do.
Okay. Mr. Representative Biskins, the other issue here is this would be significantly less than going to a district court.
Yeah.
So the balance was trying to say that we would still have a process in place. Right. It would be cheaper than going to court, and it would also take the pressure off the court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think it was my mother who always told me, just because that everyone else is doing it doesn't mean you have to.
Representative Biskins, I agree, but there's always a cost to doing something.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, is it your intent that the decisions by the administrative law judge be final, or is there an appealable process written in this
process? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, the decision of the administrative law judge is final, but it is appealable to the Court of Appeals. And that is also the case in the campaign complaint situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do we have anyone else who wishes to testify? Or question, Representative Lanning, to Mr. Johnson?
My question, Mr. Chair, thank you, is okay. A question to you or
right.
Ms. Nairn. Can you explain why the complaints on the open meeting law were removed from the bill?
Yes, I can. The open meeting law portion of the bill is still being worked on, and there were complications that made it impossible to continue to work on this and proceed. So what we decided to do was move forward with that part of the bill that we could handle this session. We're still working on the open meeting law. It will not be put back into this bill, but you'll see that once we've worked out with all of the various entities a bill we can move through the legislature. So there were just problems. This is a short session, and we'll handle the best that we can do with what we have. That's about all I can say. Any further discussion here? Representative Kahn.
The Chairman, I have a question on line 520.
Representative Kahn.
There's some language that says substantially prevail. No, I'm not sure where that is.
Representative Kahn, there's a new delete everything amendment, and I think you need to go to the one dated 2/23/10.
Yep.
All right.
Okay, that's 536.
So where are you now?
536.
All right, 536.
What does substantially prevailing plaintiff mean?
I'm going to have to refer that to Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that is a term of art that has been given a settled meaning by the appellate courts, and that's why that particular language was used.
What's the other place?
Representative Kahn.
So that's the same thing. 531 is the other place, a complainant who substantially prevails. People.
Mr. Understand. Johnson.
What does it mean? Wins most of them or what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, it doesn't mean numbers of people. It means that they prevail substantially on the issues that were to be adjudicated. Substantially simply means the judge's decision might not coincide exactly with the relief sought by one of the parties, but they may get most of what they asked for. I mean, that's the best I can do. I don't have the definition of that that's been, as it's defined by the Supreme Court, with me right now, and I could do better if I had.
Okay, Rev. Semkon.
Question is it 51% or 76% or 99%?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kahn, it isn't in terms of percentages. I don't know how else to say it.
Mr. Chairman, I know I have the wrong background to be interacting with this.
Mr. Chair, perhaps some...
Representative Kahn, you said it. Mr. Johnson, you want to continue with this, or should we...
No, unless Representative Kahn wants to hear more from me, Mr. Chair, I would...
All right.
No,
I would defer. Representative Kiffmeyer.
I'm just not used to those kind of words.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On occasion, being an attorney is a good thing. Okay. I would like to say that in regards to Mr. Neumeister's bringing up something that I had noticed this anyway, and this is line 535, reasonable attorney fees. Was there some consideration given to the fact that a regular citizen might make use of this and they're not an attorney? May they have costs that wouldn't be defined usually as attorney fees, but are still the costs of their effort?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, there actually is a mechanism for that in the Minnesota Equal Access to Justice Act, which does allow in some cases parties who are not lawyers to recover, in some cases, the value of their own time. Now, there are conditions attached to that. I don't know that I should go into that now, but there is a mechanism in another statute that, at least in some cases, permits that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So would it be, in your opinion, then, that that would, with the current language that is in here, that you and the administrative law judge section would have the authority you would need to make that determination with this current language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the way that particular statute operates is after there's a final decision in the case, the prevailing party can petition the administrative law judge for fees and costs. As I say, it's limited to certain kinds of petitioners, and the costs are limited to some extent. But it's something that happens after the case is finished. I don't know if that helps.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that it's just really a simpler yes or no. Do you have what you need under this current language, or do we need to add something to make sure that Equal Access to Justice Act is included in your determination, or do you automatically do that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the act is self-executing. In other words, by virtue of our issuing a final decision, triggers the act. So that the act takes care of that. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
I think that was a yes.
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer, yes.
Is there an attorney here that can
get a better answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm Johnson. Sorry, I'm an attorney as well as a judge, and that's kind of what attorneys say sometimes.
Right. I appreciate it. I think we got it.
Members, I have one more individual wishes to testify that wasn't on the list, and if there are no further questions here, I'm going to bring that Richard Heller had sent a note down. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, hi, my name is Rick Heller. Just thought I'd come up and testify on this because I've been in contact with an iPad, I believe. And I think it's related with this. My conversation with them was they're understaffed there, and that impacts their work. They're currently in process of informing a lot of the agencies throughout the state about compliance with apparently this Chapter 13. They do have meetings. I thought they were open, but they weren't. They were closed. As a parent, I'd like to understand the process too for compliance. I think it's important. Not only does the public agency know, but the public, and they don't have any meetings for that for confidentiality reasons. They invite the agencies in the state there so they can talk openly about it. If they had an outsider, they may not be as well open to discuss the concerns. As you know, one of the things is classification. As the agencies formulate what is classified, what isn't, appropriate people, then they can tell the individual what's classified, what's not. I like the whole idea of transparency. I think it's important. It seems like a lot of the stuff that these agencies work hard on is like a birthday present. They give it to you when it's all done, but for engagement reasons, some people would like to know ahead of time where they're going with it, so they could perhaps call a meeting publicly and have a meaningful discussion with agencies as they make these internal decisions. I don't believe public, they could have input, but they're not there to micromanage it. I suggest, I know this may not be related to the bill right now, however, I think you need to consider in the future of letting the public get informed on this in the same way as the state agencies. It's just about, you know, being equally informed. I myself came up here last year and I talked about how I had a print disability and how IDA covers that, you know, K through 12. But, you know, after K through 12 comes ADA. And uh, I, uh, I had difficulty accessing the system, including the appellate court. I can't write and I can't hardly read. But I worked on it, did what I could with it. Yet when I see it, I see this $1,000 in there again, and I see there's a barrier. When I asked, for instance, a school district for all their data, and they gave me the flip of where that it's not a, it's not created, nor do we have it. Yet when I find out that MCAs are being correlated with MAP testing by NWA, district, statewide, and then probably this district, and I can't even look at the information to get an idea of where they're going with it all. I have an issue with it because I like to know when my child has no growth on brick testing, and it appears like nothing's happening there, but there, it's one thing learning something, another thing applying it, you know. Also, since I do ProSay, I think as a parent I have that privilege according to federal rules, and that kind of ties into this piece as well. And as far as the burden of proof, or rebuttal of presumption, $50 I don't think is appropriate either, because frankly, if the party prevails, I didn't know they had to pay $50. Of course, I'm probably unlearned on this. And as far as this word of violation of technical, again, that's probably my guess. Is got to, I don't know if that means that's got to do with classification, you know, as far as if are they required to classify information? Is that a technical error? Or what's genuine uncertainty? I mean, I guess obviously I'm not a lawyer. I'd like to know that when I find out a district is deleting emails and they're shared among themselves, and the Minnesota Department of Education cannot rule on anything like that, even though it's federal, because it's not just jurisdiction, that they don't give me any direction where I'm supposed to go, so I got to try to figure this pathway out, how it fits. I am at a loss with that because the public don't have a clue. At least in my little world. And when I find out it costs $5,000 to freeze up a hard drive on a district and have them deduct if anything was taken off an email because one of my kids failing grades in classroom and he's struggling in there, I like to know what's going on. I like transparency, but I tell you what, the administrators are standing in the way. And teachers become intimidated, but they never tell you that publicly. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr.
Any questions?
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, then I'm going to lay House File 2899 over until Tuesday. This will be the first bill up on the agenda, and we will be working off the bill as amended. The next bill on the agenda is House File 440, Representative Eakin. He was here. I saw him. There he is. Representative Eakin, I'm going to move that House File 440 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have an amendment to get it in the shape and form that I would like, the A2 amendment.
I'll move the A2 amendment. And any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Why don't you explain your bill as amended, Representative Eakin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to hear my bill today. This is a bill which a constitutional amendment which would require that in order to hold public office in the state, you need to win by at least 50% of the vote in the general election. The reason that I offer this bill is because of some of the problems we've had with the current plurality system. We have, for instance, just in the last United States Senate race, we had no one winning a majority of the popular vote. In the last three governor's elections, we have not had anyone win by a majority of the popular vote. This leads to a situation where it's actually possible for the less popular candidate to win. And in order to illustrate that, I can use a hypothetical situation. Imagine for a moment that we have a deficit, a big deficit. And imagine that there are three candidates running for governor, and the big issue is how to deal with that deficit. And let's say that a majority, 60% of the people in the state, want to fix it through a mix of taxes, cuts, and shifts. But 40% want to do it just through cuts and shifts. Now, if you've got three candidates that are running for governor, and two of them are running on a platform of doing it through the mix of cuts, shifts, and taxes, they could split up that 60%, say 25% for one, 35% for another, and the less popular candidate could win with 40% of the vote, really thwarting the will of the people. Now, I'm not saying that's what's happened or that that's what will happen, but that is what could happen. It could go the other way as well. Imagine a surplus, and maybe trying to deal with that, and you've got candidates that are advocating for tax cuts to deal with it, others who want to have more investments and more spending. You could end up with a situation where the majority of people want to have tax cuts. And if you've got two candidates that are both running on that platform, again, the votes could be split up so that the one who is less popular could win. So it's not partisan. I just want to make that clear. As I've already said, the last U.S. Senate race was won by a Democrat, and that was not won by a majority. As a matter of fact, you look at the last four elections, two of those last four elections, a majority of those that won by plurality were Republicans. The other two, the majority of those who won by plurality were Democrats. So it cuts both ways, and I want to make that clear. But it does, I think, pose the possibility of thwarting the will of the people. And we'll never know for sure if that's been happening because we've never gone back to find out who, in fact, does have the majority of support. This amendment would require that so that we will know who, in fact, does have the majority of the people behind them. I also wanted to bring up the possibility of manipulation or shenanigans being played with the current system. One example that I was made aware of was the U.S. House race between John Klein and Bill Luther. There was a candidate who entered the race as a candidate for the No New Taxes Party named Sam Garst. Sam Garst was, in fact, a DFLer. He, in fact, was very active in the Sierra Club. He did not believe in the No New Taxes Party, but he entered his name into the race in order to peel votes away from John Klein and help Bill Luther win that congressional race. These things do happen. That was revealed before the election, fortunately, but Sam Garst still received 5% of the vote in that election. And in a close election, that's enough to throw the election one way or the other. So I also want to address one more thing with this bill. I know there have been concerns that it doesn't offer a detailed plan of action as to how to accomplish this goal. And for those who do have that concern, I think that it's important to point out that the Constitution really has never been meant to be a rigid and inflexible document of detailed provisions. The reason that our U.S. Constitution has endured so long is because it is flexible. And our founders understood the importance of that, that the Constitution was to establish general principles, ideals, and goals, but then leave room for the Constitution to breathe, to grow, and to change. Our Constitution, the United States Constitution, has often been referred to as a living, breathing document, and that's because it doesn't get into the detailed provisions, it gets into the general principles. And that's what I'm trying to do here. I think we should follow the example that's been set by our founders, laying down in the Constitution, the highest law in the land, the general principles and ideals that we should all be striving for. This simply establishes an ideal of democracy, the ideal that the will of the people should prevail. It doesn't lay down a detailed path. That must be done by the people's representatives. And because it doesn't lay down a detailed path, it does leave room to grow and to evolve. But it does require that whatever path we take, it must lead to a government that better reflects the will of the people.
All right. Questions to the bill as amended? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ekin,
right down the line.
Certainly I can understand how people initially would react to this by saying, well, that's the way it ought to be. You ought to have a majority of the votes. The problem or the concern that I have with this is that when people vote on this, they're not going to know how we're going to do this, how it's going to take place. And we just talked about transparency in government. I think it's very important for people to know in advance what are the implications of their vote. And in this case, on the surface it may seem that's a good idea, but when they find out that they may have to go back to the polls a third time in the same election cycle because there needs to be a runoff election, or they may have to vote for their second choice, and they may not want to be forced to do that, they may have a very different view of this constitutional amendment. Now, take case in point, the legacy amendment. On the surface, that seemed like a good idea, and the majority of people in Minnesota voted for it. Would have a majority of the people voted for that if they had known what the budget forecast that was going about to come out with the kind of deficit that we were facing? I think the vote of a lot of people would have changed. And so to me, if we're going to be transparent here, it's important for people to know when they're asked this question, you know, how is it going to be implemented? And they may have a different opinion if that's the case. Reaction.
Representative Ekin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, and I think that's a good question, but I think that this is going to engage people in that discussion, and it can change as time goes on if we find a system that works better. But again, it just lays down a guiding principle here, which I think most people can agree is a worthy cause for which to pursue and to try to accomplish. The fact is that there are different options available, and the people can certainly make their concerns and their ideas known through their elected representatives. And it's the elected representatives who will be laying out the details, and they will be listening to their constituents. So I'm convinced that whatever system is selected is the one that the people are going to going to support the most.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the big concerns I have is tailing right off of Representative Lanning's concerns is that people aren't going to be aware of what mode we're going to use, what mechanism the legislature is going to create, and I understand what you're saying in that we need to be flexible, but I see two possible ways of doing that, either by the ranked choice or by instant runoff elections, both of which consume huge costs, and I would assume a huge burden on local governments. Have you had interactions with some local government units and what their thoughts are would be in having to possibly hold a second or third election?
Representative Ekin.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, I have discussed it with some of the local officials in my area who think that it's a good idea, just because they do also endorse and support the concept of majority rule. And I think that as far as, and by the way, this does leave until 2014 to implement such a plan, so there's plenty of time to plan and prepare for that time. As far as the cost, that depends on what kind of a system that you decide to establish. And I do think that it's important to point out, again, this is the guiding principle, and I think it's good for us to establish the goals first and then work on the details about how to get there. I don't want to get lost and put the cart before the horse, so to speak, in not talking about the goals first. We need to set up goals first, and then we can figure out how to get there. And this will engage the public. I think it brings the public into the debate. I think it's an important one to have. And again, the people will decide in November whether or not they want to support this principle of majority rule. And I'm sure that the details will be coming out as the different possibilities of how to get there during that debate.
Yeah. So finish. No, one more. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my thoughts on this. I do think we are putting the cart before the horse here. You in your own testimony mentioned that we wanted to follow the example set by the founders. Will they set up a system of plurality? You said that, your own definitions, that our election system of plurality is bipartisan. It does work. The goal of every legislator is to get a majority of the vote, and that's our job, is to produce a message where we get a majority of the votes. So I do think the system that we have does work, and the goal is certainly there to get a majority of the vote. But until we have a concrete plan that we can lay before the voters and tell them this is what we mean by a majority of the vote and how we're going to do it, we're asking them to make a blind decision, in my opinion, so I don't support it.
Representative Kahn.
Very briefly, one of the things I think that this bill, and I do support the bill, and I do think it's a good idea, but I think it needs some implementing dates and something. For example, you said 2014, but there are general elections which will occur in 2012, so if this is passed in 2010, you'd really have one legislative session to put it in place for those. The other thing is, and this is a question I've been asking about our constitutional requirement for a balanced budget, which is the question I've asked about the balanced budget, and I would ask it about this one if we were to pass it, is, who goes to jail if the budget isn't balanced? My good friend Phil Krenke told me, I write the bill and I should say in the bill, who goes to jail if the budget isn't balanced? But in Section 10, when we start at one point, the legislature shall provide by law. We've sometimes seen gridlock in the legislature. It requires the legislature and the governor. So what happens if the legislature doesn't do this by 2012? Who goes to jail if the legislature doesn't provide it by law?
Representative Eakin.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, we do already have situations where legislature is required to do things by the Constitution, as you said, the balanced budget. And if they don't, the courts do intervene. If the legislature, for instance, does not perform its responsibilities for reapportionment, which is going to be coming up soon, that's also constitutionally required. Again, the courts will step in to ensure that those responsibilities are carried out. The same thing would be true in this case. I would anticipate that the legislature failed to reach some kind of agreement, again, the courts would have to intervene to ensure that there is a mechanism in place to ensure a majority winner. I think that also places pressure on the legislature to get it done, and that's the way it was meant to be.
I've got six people on my list, so Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I wanted to respond quickly to Representative Sanders' comment about somehow ranked choice voting is onerous and expensive, and we had a I think there was an implication that these alternatives could create undue burdens, and we had an experiment which was not really an experiment. It's now the rule in Minneapolis. We have instant runoff voting, and it worked very well this past election. Voters liked it. It wasn't expensive. It didn't create burdens on election officials, and it was very, very successful. So I think that when we look at, is this constitutional amendment some of the options, and I would prefer ranked choice voting. I think that's the way we ought to go to reform the system. It is something that works. In the largest city in the state, we've proved it works. And I think, I guess I'd like the author to respond in terms of how this could lead towards that.
Sure.
Representative Eakin.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, it certainly is one of the options, one of the possibilities here to meeting the requirements of this constitutional amendment. There are other options out there as well, however. I maybe point out the Washington system, where they have two primaries, one to choose the party candidates and the second one to narrow that down to the top two of those who then go on to the general. So there are different ways of accomplishing this goal. And again, though, the goal needs to be established first, I think, I think to force the issue and to, again, establish a more democratic system.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And there is precedent for our founding fathers requiring a majority. For example, the 12th Amendment requires a majority of the electoral votes for a president to be elected, or it goes into the House and the Senate. In our own state constitution, Article 4 says that all bills, before they become law, have to be a majority vote of all the members, not just those vote, all the members. To ratify a constitution requires a majority vote of affirmative vote of all people voting. So there's precedent there, and I think if we did this, we should just go with the goals rather than the details, because who knows, maybe 30, 40 years down the road, computers will be so secure that polling places won't be necessary and there'd be little cost. So you could vote one day from your home, if there's not a majority, 2 days later you could vote again at no extra cost. If you were to zero that in and put it, then you'd have to change it further. So I do think that part could change a little bit. I don't know if we'll be there in 40 years, Mr. Chair, but who knows?
Representative Marquardt, the way the emails were working yesterday, it's not likely. Representative Gutwalt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Eakin, appreciate what you're doing. I have no doubt you're sincere in what you're trying to do, but the devil is in the details. And setting a dramatic goal, as this question is worded for the people in the state of Minnesota, boy, they're going to look at that and go, yeah, doggone it, the majority should do it. Absolutely. They don't know the details behind that. They don't know the implications. I happen to know from my own local officials, they are concerned about the costs involved here. So it sounds real good to say, let's just set that goal on the hill and then figure out the details later, because I would bet you most people would vote for this, and then we got it in the Constitution, and then we've got things like ranked choice voting that not everybody agrees on, and that there needs to be a much deeper dialogue about before we would move to that. We also don't have a lot of demand for these changes. I can think of situations where we've got three candidates, a third-party candidate. You mentioned a case where that might have been done in kind of an underhanded way, but there are also cases where that's being done in a perfectly legitimate way, and somebody wins the election with less than the majority vote, but nonetheless has won in a field of three, maybe even four candidates. Maybe there's a write-in candidate. We have to be concerned about those sorts of things, because then we get into this cycle of ranked choice voting or whatever other mechanism we use that starts getting a little bit away from the intent of what we're trying to do. So it sounds very good on the surface, but in practice it's got some extraordinary costs at this point. As I mentioned, I don't think ranked choice voting is something that's been embraced by the majority in this state. The examples that Representative Marquardt brings up are typically yes-no situations. You have two choices. When you have two choices, it makes sense. When you're voting on something, yes or no is two choices, and a majority should rule. But you don't always have that in the case where you're electing representatives. And in representative government, that's a potential situation every time. There might be a third, a fourth, a fifth candidate. And do we really want to get into this system? So I think there are a lot of questions that get left unanswered, and I think it's frankly unfair to put before the voters something as simple as this and then tell them, oh, we'll get to the details later. The devil is in the details, and they need to be thinking about that as a total rather than as a simple answer. So I laud the goal, but when you dive just below the surface, there's a lot of problems with it.
Representative Eakin,
Mr. Chair, we're
getting close to the end of our time here.
Okay. Well, Representative Gottwald, I just thought I'd mention again, in the U.S. Constitution, some of the vaguer amendments that were added include freedom of speech and freedom of press and freedom of religion, and they never got into the details either. And the devil is in the details, but the devil isn't in the U.S. Constitution, and it's not in this amendment. So,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say it definitely is. When you have the word provide by law for a mechanism, And now, what if you said in there instead, provide by law for ranked choice voting? Then it'd be an honest amendment that the people could actually take a look at. But you don't. You bury this mechanism, and then they see the majority of the vote. And so I don't think it's really being honest with the people by wording this amendment this way for what they are truly voting for. And I object to that. I think when people are having an amendment, especially an amendment put in front of them, that we owe it to them to talk about that mechanism. And to not do so more or less appears as though you're afraid to tell them what you're really trying for here. And the other thing is that a constitutional amendment, often you have cycles. If you look back in the history of the election records, you'll have different cycles where you will go through clearly majority all the time. And then you have a situation which we have rather recently in the state of Minnesota where we have some other parties. And they go through that process, and they go through that, and usually the cycle comes out. And so the risk we have here is when we become reactionary to a cycle and then go to the Constitution. And you see that happening in a variety of things this way. And it's like anything, changing some of these things in a reactionary mode in a cycle is not a good idea. Let's let it go for a while. And usually in this cycle, it does come through. So I object to this bill on both of those, and there are other reasons as well, but predominantly for those two reasons.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Egan, it seems to me that there are at least two, but primarily two, ways that we could handle this if this were to be in the Constitution. One would be ranked choice voting. The other, as you alluded to, would be kind of a top two, regardless of party primary, where you could have two Republicans on the general election ballot, or two Democrats, or two something else. Do you have a preference as to what the follow-up mechanism would be?
Representative Egan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I do not have any preference as to what the follow-up one may be. And by the way, as far as the system that you were talking about with the two primaries, the system they have in Washington wouldn't result in two from the same party. It would be two from differing parties. Right?
Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can attest to the fact that I know the main organization in the state that is an advocate for ranked choice voting, or IRV as it's also known, is Fair Vote Minnesota, and they have not taken a position on this bill. So I understand that some people feel, and it might be natural to conclude, that this is just kind of a Trojan horse for ranked choice voting, but I really don't believe that's the case. I've been working with that organization on a bill that I'm carrying that would simply allow, not mandate, but allow cities, statutory cities as opposed to charter cities, to experiment with ranked choice voting, not dictating that they have to, but saying they can, which now they can't. A charter city, or rather a statutory city that wishes to right now, is handcuffed and can't. This would just allow them to do that. I've been carrying that bill, and I've been working with Ms. Massey, who I see is here, and that organization. I have to tell you, in the run-up to this bill, I asked them, and I know they've been involved, and they absolutely and sincerely take no position on this. And I think were your motive to be just to ram through secretly ranked choice voting, they would have been all over this, and they're not. So I just want people to understand that I believe that Representative Egan's motives are pure in this, and that this is not some sort of Trojan horse designed to kind of diabolically impose ranked choice voting.
Rep. Sims-Turner.
Yes, thank you, Chair Pawlowski and Representative Egan. My question has to do with more. Have you heard from the third parties in Minnesota, you know, what they're in favor of? Because I guess depending what the mechanism is, it could be very advantageous for them, or it could be pretty detrimental to them. And I'm just wondering if they've gave you some feedback on this.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Sterner, I have not received feedback from the third parties on this issue, so I wouldn't know where. I would guess that different third parties might have different opinions on the matter, and it might depend on what they think may be the mechanism that's put into place. I would guess that they may have mixed feelings if I had to guess what their reaction would be.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eakin, I think everyone would agree that the chances of the next governor of Minnesota getting less than 50% of the vote is probably pretty good, because there probably will be at least a three-way race this year. What would happen, Representative Eakin, if the legislature chose either one of those options and the next governor said, I don't like it, and he or she vetoes it, and there's not enough to override, and your date, whether it's 2012 or 2014, has is coming, what happens then? If the legislature and the governor can't agree on the system, does that mean that the people who do get elected by a plurality can't take office? Is that what the implication of this would be?
Representative Beacon.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, again, the courts would have to intervene at that point if there isn't an agreement. And I think that that's kind of the hammer, too, that will assure there is going to be an agreement, because I don't think anybody's going to want to abdicate that responsibility or turn that over to the courts. The same thing with the balanced budget requirements in the Constitution. The same thing applies there. And I think that's a good example of, a general principle being placed in the Constitution. It says balanced budget. It doesn't say it has to be done through cuts or through taxes or through half of each. It just says a balanced budget. And all mine says is you need a majority.
Representative Lanning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Eakin, I would find it very hard to believe that any court would do anything but say you can't take office. If this is a constitutional amendment, that seems to me to draw the line. I don't know how any court could say, well, we'll extend this or let it go on another 2 years or whatever. I think no. This could end up in a constitutional crisis.
And Mr. Chair, and we're almost out of time.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, just a quick response. I don't believe that the courts would do that. I think the courts understand the importance of having people serve as our governor and as our state legislators, and they will put into place a mechanism to assure that happens.
All right, members, we're almost out of time. The motion on the bill is to pass House File 440 as amended and it be re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The bill is not passed. Thank you, members. Representative Poppe.
I'd like to move the minutes of February 24th.
Representative Poppe moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.